apologise for only being here for a short time. It is the Resurgence Conference, another part of Oxford. Otherwise, I'd have thoroughly enjoyed spending the weekend and taking part in the wider discussion. Secondly, I'm not doing a PowerPoint presentation on purpose, because I've got an allergy to them now. I go to so many climate conferences, and I spend so much time looking at graphs, that I finally can't cope with them anymore, and I decided, just if you don't mind, just to talk about what we're trying to do. I'm going to begin, if I may, for sort of personal reasons. I always find that one of the dangers about climate change is it's always done very much from a technical perspective, hence the graphs. Terribly necessary. But sometimes I think it's the personal things that actually catches one. Lars yesterday, I believe, spoke about what is going on in the developing world. And quite soon after I began working for Action for a Global Climate Community, I found myself travelling, and I've travelled most of my life very widely, but to places talking to people about what is going on in their lives. One of the first things I discovered, which I didn't know before, talking to the Inuit people in northern Canada, was that if you build an igloo, it's better to build it on ice than on the frozen earth, because ice only goes down to naught, and the frozen earth goes down a lot colder. So that was kind of interesting for me. I always assumed that ice was the coldest, but of course it gets colder than that. They, however, are finding it impossible now to build on the ice, because the ice is cracking. It is melting. So on the earth, they are building not just igloos, but indeed wooden houses that themselves are moving because the permafrost is beginning to melt. And talking to people who are living on the edge of global warming, right there when it's happening, you get a whole new image. They're watching differences in migration patterns of birds, of animals, when they can hunt, when they can't hunt. They are fully, fully aware that global warming is happening. Then I found myself in Kenya, in a small Maasai village, talking to people there about it. Again, they actually experience it. They see the changes of climate. They are experiencing the growth of vector-borne diseases as the world gets hotter. They are worried, extremely worried, about water and what's going to happen. And some of you may know, in parts of Kenya, there have been disturbances between Maasai and other tribes over the need for water. It was with the Maasai that I looked at Mount Kilimanjaro and saw the snow line changing. There is now a much smaller snow line than there was before. And this has been repeated throughout different parts of the world. You watch people talking about their experience of what is changing. On a much more local level, gardeners in England realise there are changes. Many of the books that have been written about when you go and see this garden or that garden no longer quite apply, because flowers are coming to bloom at a different time, the blossom and the autumns are changing, and we actually experience it. On a much bigger level, of course, in India, where I have spent a lot of my time over the last 2 years, you're seeing two things happening. One, you're seeing a massive opportunity for economic growth, but at the same time, people are getting more and more aware that global warming could devastate the Indian economy. Devastate it actually in two ways. There's the macro way, which is the general heating up of the climate, and what that will mean, again, in terms of disease, in terms of agricultural patterns, in terms of water shortage, and above all, when I say water shortage, in terms of what could be happening to the glaciers and the Himalayas. From the Himalayas, the water flows to allow a third of the world to have fresh water. If those glaciers eventually melt and disappear, there will first be flooding, then there will later be the drought that is going to be worse than biblical in the way it actually hits Asia, China, India, Bangladesh, Nepal, Burma, the whole of South and Southeast Asia. But there's also a micro issue. Because of the growth of chemicals going into the atmosphere, over Mumbai, most particularly, as the Potsdam Institute has shown, there may well be some reflection of heat, which means that the monsoon patterns may change. We may get years without monsoons, and then suddenly desperate and terrible monsoons that will flood wide areas. But how do you actually deal with a country that is facing that, and yet its first priority is how do you get electricity to 600 million people? How is development going to happen in the villages where people don't have the light to read by, where kids coming back from school don't have the opportunity, any opportunity at all, to link in with the kind of technology that the rest of the world is moving forward? So a government like India, and you could repeat this throughout the world, has to say on the one hand, how do we deal with development? And on the other hand, how do we deal with the climate change that will come from the development process that we are engaged in? I spent some time in East Africa talking to the East African Legislative Assembly, and those who don't know it, it's an interesting body of people. Back in the 1960s, Kenya and Uganda and Tanzania tried to build an economic community to rather mirror the European economic community, but it collapsed, not least because of Idi Amin, but it was going down the hill anyway. And they've tried to revive something rather similar recently, based upon getting some sort of free trade between those three groups. And there is an assembly based of, I think, 9 people who were appointed from the different parliaments of Kenya, Uganda and Tanzania. And I was invited to go and speak to their environment committee. And it was very interesting because that was the issue they were talking about. How do we square development with the need at this point in time to use carbon, because it's still the cheapest form of energy. We can cut down trees and burn them. You know, we're going to get energy. With what is going to happen to Africa in the long run. There was a great deal of anger in saying it's all very well for the West to talk about cutting back, but the West has already got its economic development. I mean, it's no point in turning to us and say, you know, it's your problem. It's actually the problem that you have created. But then as the discussion continued, it got kind of interesting, because we began to talk about what was meant by development. Did Africa truly want to follow the pattern of development that the West has taken, with all the problems that come with it, with the pollution, with the noise, with all the violence that comes and the problems that come with extreme growth and the urbanization? Well, the truth is, yes and no is the only answer. Yes, to some extent, because those are the images that are now conveyed worldwide and getting people to want to see change. No, because a lot of people there are beginning to understand that A, it is unachievable without a massive cost, and B, in the long run, it may not be the kind of development that Africa wants. But these are fundamentally esoteric questions if one looks worldwide at the whole question of globalization and economic growth. Now, starting with some of these ideas, a few years back, a couple of people, a man called John Pinder, who has, and some of you may know of him, has an eminent record as one of the great writers about European federalism, and Christopher Layton, who was also in the European Union as the Director General for some time, began to say, how can we look for some way of taking a leap in the thinking? We have, of course, the Kyoto discussions and the Kyoto Protocol, and the agreement by Annex 1 countries to reduce their emissions. Kyoto has been fundamentally important, but with over 180 countries negotiating, it is clear that we're not going to get the enormous breakthroughs that we need. And I'm sure all your speakers up to now have emphasized the fact that we do need to have enormous breakthroughs. One of my friends, one of the people I admire most in the scientific field, is Professor John Schellenhuber, who used to be director of the Tyndall Institute, who comes to Oxford regularly as a visiting professor, and who is also the director of the Potsdam Institute on Climate Change in Germany. John has now been appointed to head up the German government's scientific team for their presidency in the European Union and the G8 next year. And when I sit opposite John and he says, we have a window of 10 to 15 years to seriously begin to change things, then I believe it. I don't know how many of you remember the famous Tom Lehrer song in the 1960s when he said about the development of the atomic bomb. He said, if Einstein's scared, I'm scared. And I feel the very same way about John. If John is saying, be warned, I feel warned. So when we read in the newspapers, we're doing all the time, of people saying we must do something, and the politicians saying, yes, we've got to sort of think about cutting back, and we've got to do this, and we've got to do that, but actually not tackling it head on, one begins to feel scared that this is going to run away with us. Just on a small point, a sort of digression, I heard the other day that Prime Minister Blair, having for a long time argued the case for not going about 450 parts per million, was talking to the Germans about, well, maybe 550 parts per million. 550 parts per million is a seriously dangerous tipping point, as many scientists have pointed out. And they cannot model everything, but they're pretty certain that things could be extremely dangerous if we go to the 550 parts per million. Already we're seeing, and I don't know how many of you read The Independent over the last week, the scientists are having to revise their worries about what is going on because it's happening faster. You have it right there. Absolutely. Disappearing world. So let me go back to the development what John Pinder and Chris Layton were thinking. Both of them had experience of Europe. John, with actual memories of it happening, were thinking about what was it that brought the six countries of the European Union, who began it together over 50 years ago. Gone through a devastating war, it had been a sense, as they had at the end of the First World War, of never again. But what could make it different? And the great thinking that came, those of you who know, from Jean Monnet and Robert Schuman, was to say, let's see if we can find concrete ways of linking the economies of France and Germany, primarily, and then Italy, Holland, Belgium, and Luxembourg, who joined as well. And the obvious thing was to look at the prime engine of the economy, which was then the production of coal and steel. And there was a development of the coal and steel community that, extraordinary in historical terms, meant the pooling of resources for the development and the marketing of coal and steel between these two historical enemies. And as we know from history, I still think one of the most extraordinary political experiments in human history, that small group is now 25 countries and growing. Common currency, an open market, and so forth. Now, of course, there are many people who say, well, there are problems. Yes, there are bound to be problems. I mean, these are extraordinary historical leaps forward to bring people who have been historic enemies together into a common parliament. But the driving force was originally the coal and steel community that then led to the economic community. And basing that thinking, John and Christopher began to say, well, what is it now? Now we know there has got to be a global approach to the climate. What is it that could begin to bring this about? I mean, I always love the idea of the person from Mars who watches this planet in total amazement. Here we are facing these utter disasters that are coming with climate change, and what are we doing? We're fighting a war here, we're having a quarrel here, we're saying the United Nations isn't effective enough here, we're not giving it resources there, and so on. It is a sort of collective madness, and the tragedy is, and maybe that collective madness is it, those whom the gods wish to destroy, they first drive mad. Well, let's, for the sake of argument, let's be a little bit more optimistic than this, and say they also give us rational intelligence to be able to move forward. So what John and Christopher developed was this idea of saying, how do we use the imperative of the environment to create some sort of north-south community that sees a common interest, and how do we move forward on that process? And Christopher wrote an extremely interesting pamphlet setting out what was going on in terms of global warming, and to develop the idea of the creation of a climate community. I'll come back to that in a minute. At the same time, pretty much, in fact, having begun a little bit earlier, a man called Aubrey Mayer, some of you may have heard of, began to develop the thinking of what was called contraction and convergence. And Aubrey, with some quite brilliant thinking took the basic line of saying, what is it that links us? And what is it that links north and south the entire globe? We all need air to breathe. And if we all need air to breathe, surely the logic is we should all have equal entitlements to that air. And if we have equal entitlements to that air, surely we should have equal entitlements to the production of those chemicals that actually destroy our atmosphere, in other words, carbon. Why can't we accept the principle of equity of emissions? Now, this is something that's an idea that's been going around for a long time. I was in the Delhi Sustainable Development Summit 2 years ago when the chief negotiator for India said quite openly, at the heart of Indian policy is the basis of per capita equity. It is the only fair way forward. So Aubrey took this idea, and then he took the concept that we have to have a clear scientific target to reduce our global emissions to, which for the sake of argument is somewhere between 60, 70 and 80%. No one can be quite sure within the next 30 to 40 years. I mean, let's just take an arbitrary one. Let's take 60% in 40 years. Global emissions of greenhouse gases have to decline by that amount. So what you do is you take the end target, you take the present target, you divide the emissions by the population of the world, you take a certain date to do it at, then you aggregate it country by country. And that is the allotment of every country's global emissions. In the process of decline, you're still going to have that decline. So you get down finally to a level of emissions that keeps you below the 550 parts per million. But in the process of getting there, of course, countries can trade those emissions with each other. Now, very obviously, for parts of Africa, that would be an enormous input of development assistance. How it's traded, whether it's traded through cash or assistance or technology, that can be decided. But the objective is that those countries who are the poorest would have an injection of technology and cash to allow them to leapfrog the carbon economy and to begin to move forward to a new type of development. Now, one of the things that's probably worth bearing in mind at the moment is that climate change, as it stands, is going to undo all the money that has been given by debt relief. I mean, we already know that. The whole debt relief argument is going to be undone by the costs of climate change. Africa particularly does not remotely have the infrastructure or the ability to deal with the adaptation process that is going to be required as water shortage and disease grows and so on and so forth. All, may I say, within a situation where the population of the world is due to go up by another 3 billion in 30 years. So Africa does not have that. This is one ability, one attempt to how do we redress this balance. Now, contraction and convergence has entered the debate. And it is a fascinating and a very profound way of saying to the world, this is how we can save this planet. If China and India choose to go the way that the developed, economically developed world has gone so far, we're going to need another 2 or 3 planets to be able to cope with this. It cannot be done. Contraction and convergence offers a clear model of how it should go. However, those, I think, who operate in the political field know that people don't sign up to blueprints. It requires a lot of discussion and negotiation as to how bits might be adapted. So what John and Christopher then said was, is there some way we could persuade some countries from the global north and some countries from the global south to take the lead in this, in much the same way that Germany and France took the lead in the creation of the European Economic Community. I should add, of course, in 1951, Britain kept out of all this. Britain played the role that America is kind of playing now. We don't need this, you know. We're going at ourselves. We have a relationship with the States. We have a relationship with our previous empire. We have some sort of relationship with Europe, but we can survive without. And I'll come back to that in a minute. How do we get, though, some sort of relationship between the global north and the global south? And what they thought was, and I think they are absolutely right, which is why I joined them on that team, was that Europe does hold a very, very important potential here. Europe has understood collective action. Europe collectively has signed up to the Kyoto Agreement. Europe has already operating its own trading scheme for emissions. Can we get Europe to link with some countries in the South to begin to build this contraction and convergence process that would show both how it works and also the opportunities that are created by such a relationship? Because although there would be a net transfer in many respects of, has to be, of wealth and of technology, nevertheless the opportunities for new industries dealing with renewable technologies is enormous, to be able to get huge markets to develop a new type of economic growth, one that does not depend on carbon. Well, I then proceeded, I'm afraid, to use up a lot of my carbon allocations by trying to put this idea over, particularly in Brazil, in Africa, and primarily and above all in India. Why India? Well, lots and lots of reasons, and I'll come on to China in a minute, but why India? Because India is a fast developing country. It is trying now to get to match some of the growth rates that it's seen in China. It has enormous developmental problems. I said 600 million people without electricity. But also, it is a democracy. And it is trying to solve those problems through the democratic process. China has a command economy. It can say pretty much, do this, and it happens. India is much more, in a sense, got a relationship with Europe and European ways of doing things because of their belief in institution, in democratic institutions. So I spent a lot of time talking to people in India about the idea of can Europe begin to move things ahead in partnership with India. We tried also talking in Brazil, which is fascinating because Latin America has its own massive problems. In Brazil, of course, one of the biggest issues is forestation and what happens to forestation. And there was a major debate for the first time, actually, this had been opened up in the media in Brazil because they have their own solution, which is called historic responsibility. They're saying, basically, Europe and America put that carbon in there, they should be paying the price. However, that has a certain lack of political reality if you bring it back to Europe and America. We know absolutely people's lifestyles are going to have to change. But for a politician to sell it along the line of your lifestyle's changing because in the past you did this is not going to be something that's going to be very electorally satisfying for any politician. In Africa, there is a considerable interest in this whole process of contraction and convergence, and we would like to see the Africa group beginning to unite around this process. But the first and the most important partner, we believe, is India. And in India, we have begun to refine an idea which we're hoping to take very much forward over the coming few months when Germany takes over the presidency of the European Union. And that is to take some very concrete examples. The European Union, as I said, has got an emissions trading scheme. It means that companies can trade with each other according to their set criteria, their set their quotas, but can then trade with each other carbon. So that means that a company that is able to save on carbon expenditure, cut back its fuel bills, cut back its use of putting carbon into the atmosphere, can actually trade that with a company that is unable to come back for its own profit. We're saying open that up to India. Let's find some way where the European emissions trading scheme can be opened up to India. And at the same time, let's take the projects which there exist under what's called the Clean Development Mechanism. Those are basically ways in which companies can help in other countries by reducing their carbon emissions in various projects and claim back within Europe. In other words, it is a way that they can help the process in developing countries. There are a series of projects under the Kyoto scheme that allow companies to invest in clean development in those countries and claim the credits back in their own home countries. We're saying let's make that a big program. Let's ultimately say to Europe and India, we will share together the process of India leapfrogging the carbon economy, using the resources it does have, most especially solar, but many other resources, to actually try and get the development process, but without putting the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Now, yes, it is quixotic. Yes, we are on donkeys and lances riding against windmills. But the reality is, we're not at the same time. If you have a 10 to 15 year window before we could start saying, this is going too fast, and we're having to deal with all the problems, then maybe it's actually about reality and not about windmills at all. The Indians realize very well that it isn't just a question of what's happening to their own country, that if the waters rise, Bangladesh will be flooded. Already they're used. I talked to the Bangladeshi environment minister. He says, the West, forget, 200,000 people died in Bangladesh in big floods in the last decade. I mean, this is huge. But 20, 30 million could be affected if the oceans rise. And where do they go? There's only one place they can go, which is India. As well as India being flooded in its own coastal resorts. We know that tsunami is not caused by global warming, but a tsunami with the sea level a meter higher would have been utterly and totally even more devastating than we have seen so far. So then, let's look at the other options. What then if it did? What if we actually succeeded and were able to persuade the European Union and India to make some sort of agreement as a bubble within the UNFCCC? This is not an attempt to get rid of the Kyoto process whatsoever. It's an attempt to say, in this process, maybe some could take the leadership and act as a way of showing where it could go. Others, we hope, would join. In the short run, in the long run. We would very much hope if this climate community could be underway that we might also be able to persuade parts of Africa to be included. Maybe persuade Canada or Japan to partake in this idea. Though I suspect that Japan and China will make their own arrangements, whether on similar lines or different lines, it's very hard to say. We do need to have institutions with it. We need to have some sort of oversight, parliamentary oversight, which is one of the reasons that we were very keen to work with India. I believe this is a distinct possibility if we can begin to get this idea, as it already is becoming in India, onto the table of people who are decision makers. We also believe that we need to build a campaign in Europe to explain to people how necessary this is. Nothing. I really do not believe this nonsense. And people say it can all be achieved without any hindrance to growth. It will hinder growth. Endless growth is not possible, nor indeed do I believe should it be possible. There've got to be limits. But it is going to mean that people who already are living quite comfortably may have to realize, they may even have to reduce some of what they are going for. There is a massive ideological struggle to be gained. Not least, of course, in America. Well, I come back to America because I believe that America will play the role that Britain played in the 1950s. But by the 1960s, Britain was saying, can we come in? By the 1960s of the European community, Britain was seeing the advantages and actually came in, possibly to the problem of the rest of the community, but nevertheless, they came in. I believe America, when it sees, and China, when it sees, what is achievable, will then begin to understand that maybe this is the way forward. So that is the broad area of work that I have been trying to work on over the last couple of years. I very much hope that we may see some movement in the next 6 to 9 months. A lot depends on the German presidency of the European Union, whether they're prepared to put some effort into this. But I do know, finally, that 10 to 15 years is very, very short, and I am absolutely convinced that we've got to stop seeing it in terms of idealism and realism. Realism, idealism is realism these days. You've got to look for something big if we are going to have planetary survival. Thank you very much.